Emmy Louie Show. Today we're talking about new urbanism. And what is new urbanism? There's two things about new urbanism. The two tenets are that new urbanism promotes compact, walkable communities, as well as connecting those compact, walkable communities with a national rail service. And here we have talking about that is from www.newurbanism.org is Andy Kunz. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you, Emmy.
Thank you for being on the show. I know we've talked about this subject, and I'm always so fascinated by it because we have these theories and we have what we these tenets of new urbanism, and then I look around and I see, well, why is it not happening or not happening fast enough? And actually, we have made a lot of strides towards accomplishing these goals for new urbanism. And I'm speaking from a citizen standpoint. I'm speaking from being a housewife, and even someone whom I know just the other day, and she said, "Oh well, I want to locate to North Carolina, and I want to live in a nice home, but I don't want to live in a poor part of town." And it makes me realize, here I'm looking at what this person just said, and then I'm looking at the news today and yesterday about voting, and somehow I think that the best way, or somehow we vote every 4 or 5 years when we move.
Yes.
And I was thinking,
vote with your wallet.
We vote with our wallet, and we vote. That's probably one of the biggest ways we vote, besides finding someone to marry and finding an occupation and finding where to go to school, is one of the biggest things every 4 or 5 years, or for statistically speaking, most people move in the United States every 4 or 5 years. Is that correct?
And absolutely, and you're also voting
again.
Every time you either get in your car or ride a train, every time you purchase a green product or a non-green product, or which company you pick to purchase from. I mean, all of those are votes and choices that people are making, that if, you know, masses start making new choices, then companies suffer and they have to change. Like right now, look at Ford and all these big companies. Their SUV sales have dropped, and now they're all going to stop making them, or you know, slow way down in how many they make. So that's people making a choice, forcing the big companies to change.
Yes, and I wouldn't say it's a very simple choice when people, going back to where people live, because I'm thinking of this person, I'm using her as an example because this is the mindset. Okay, I gotta move somewhere. Where's a nice home? Where's the safe neighborhood? Where are my kids going to go to school? And doesn't that conversation start right there? Where my
kids
go
and a lot
to
of it is
all
based
it
on
is-
the schools. I mean, with people with kids, school age, that's almost all their decision is based on where can they be located for their kids to be in a good school. The problem is, in America, we have not been, or the builders and developers have not been providing the choice. They've all been building, you know, 90% of what they've all been building for, say, 40, 50, 60 years has been single-family subdivision. So there's not even a lot of option out there. It's, you either have to move into a very pricey urban area, or an area that's run down and maybe has a lot of crime, and, you know, you have to be a pioneer. And there's not a whole lot of those options out there.
I even had another example, and I'm drawing on these personal examples because that's how I can relate to these stories instead of making it all theory. And one of a person that I heard of was a colleague, and he's a doctor at a major university, and he decided he was going to live in town.
Hi, Peggy Lee Quayler
in
here.
Downtown,
hey,
in one of our
stories on Twitter,
and
on
he
BBS.
Had a child, and he lived there for a year, and he couldn't live there because of numerous things, number one being unsafe and not having the supermarket there. There's a whole bunch of things that need to happen for an environment to be comfortable and safe?
Well, usually it starts with some housing, and then the first people that move in are the pioneers, the risk averse, they call them, and usually end up being young singles because they don't care about the schools and they don't, you know, they want it to be a little edgy. And then once enough of them move in, then the Starbucks come and a few other things come, and then some employers move there because that's where all the young creatives live. And then little by little, the place evolves into where families can move in. But that usually takes a number of years for, you know, once it's already started its revival mode. And if you look around the country, many cities are in different stages of that. Some are completely revitalized, like, say, downtown Washington, D.C., Georgetown, places like that. Row houses are $2 million each. And then you go somewhere like Detroit, and, you know, you probably would barely come out alive if you tried to live in downtown Detroit. So those are probably the two extremes, but...
You just named the two extremes right there.
Well, those are definitely the extremes, and then every other city sort of falls somewhere in between those. And then, you know, and sometimes it happens fast. If a big developer moves in and buys, you know, six or seven city blocks and starts revitalizing, then that creates a critical mass, and then a bunch of other smaller developers come and start buying blocks around them or buildings, and quickly the place can transition into a happening place, and then everybody wants to move there. And then there's other cities that, if there's not a good job base or some good universities or something to hook to, then they just continue to squander, and the people move out instead of in. They move out to the suburbs.
And also, when I hear of people's conversations, going back to where people move, you listen to the conversation, and slowly but surely, you do hear the conversation of about knowing your neighbors and walkability.
Right.
I didn't hear it that much 5 years ago, but you hear it now.
Well, you hear it now more than ever because not only two things have happened. Traffic has gotten just horrendous in the suburbs where, you know, it's just like painful to go anywhere. You want to go and get a newspaper and you have to sit in a half hour of traffic. So it's just, it's gotten out of hand, and then gas prices. And so those two things are sort of working together to just drive more and more people back to cities or at least denser mixed use urban areas where, you know, they have some, you can actually walk and get a few of your daily needs met, and you're not, you know, a prisoner to your car and a prisoner to gas prices.
I know. And talking about car prices, I saw just on TV that this one company, this car manufacturer, is guaranteeing gas to be $3 a gallon for the next 3 years.
I'm not sure how they're doing that, unless they bought a million gallons of it. I mean, there's no way they're going to do that, literally, unless they bought a whole tanker full of it and... You know, or
they're probably subsidizing it, right?
Or they're going to send you a check every month until they go bankrupt. I don't see how, you know, there's no way anyone can do it. Even the airlines are struggling now because a lot of them that did have prices locked in, those contracts are expiring, and all of a sudden their fuel prices triple because they had them locked in at much less than what they are now.
That points out to a good point about there's certain, like even a taxi, like I took a taxi the other day, and the cost of the taxi was still the same, even though the cost of gas went up.
Well, see, taxis around here, they actually add a fuel surcharge.
Okay, so it depends on how...
And some of them are regulated by the cities pretty tightly, and some are a little more independent. If there's a lot of competition, they resist that. But if it's all regulated by the city or some local municipality, then they can, like, I rode a taxi the other day, and it was a regular fare plus, like, $2 fuel surcharge. And I was only in the taxi 15 minutes. I mean, and I understand it. I'm not even upset about it because the poor guy who's trying to make a living off that, his fuel prices are going up every day.
I know. There's some companies where eventually they would have to increase their costs.
The airlines are just, you know, they're all on the edge of bankruptcy now because they're trying, I don't know why they don't just raise their ticket prices. I mean, they're trying to charge you for luggage and bag of peanuts is now $2, and you know they're going to try to charge you for your can of soda, and next they'll charge you for seat belts. Who knows what else? I mean, they might as well just jack up the price of the ticket. But I think the reason they don't is because people will stop flying if they really jacked it up to cover their fuel costs.
That's a sign that you're being charged for everything because
they're struggling like crazy. They've cut every corner they could possibly cut, and there's nothing left to cut. So now they're starting to tack on fees. And what worries me is that every corner they've cut, one of them was maintenance.
You don't want to do that.
Well, I mean, I flew back from, I think I mentioned this on your last show, I flew back from the conference I was at in San Francisco, and two planes had malfunctioning problems, you know, and so we all had to get off the plane, and, you know, one was a fuel pump problem, and then the plane we were supposed to get on instead had landing gear problems. I was like, okay, which of these two do we want to fly on? You know, I mean, it's just, and it's obvious that they're just cutting corners. They're cutting their maintenance. They're probably cutting their staff of mechanics, and you know, all their gate staff were cut. And it, you know, it's just we're watching it unravel before our eyes.
So, what are these airline companies thinking of? What are they thinking about 10 years into the future?
I think they're all figuring they're going to be bankrupt and out of business in 10 years.
What are they going to do?
I know what they're going to. They're all going to be begging the government for bailouts. That's what's going to happen. Just like.
And then what?
Well,
that's it.
I mean, I think they need to just get smart and get in the train business. I mean, you can actually make a profit operating a train where you can't operating an airplane. The costs are 50 times more. You know, if you're in the travel business, and like the only guy who I know who's actually in both is Virgin in England, and he probably, it's real clear to him because he can look at the expenses on both halves of his business and see that the trains, he's making a profit, and the airplanes, he's probably losing his tail.
Oh, that's a good point. And
so, you know, that would be the only way they're going to save themselves is they got to get into the train business and push the government to start building a bunch of more trains, and then we'll actually still be able to move around this country.
Let's switch to the topic about trains. Trains, the electric trains are very quiet, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
They're not the spewing out kind of
those are diesel, the ones you're thinking of.
Yeah, because when you say train, somehow I just have this picture of your choo-choo and this huge.
Oh no, though, you're thinking of the early ones. That was steam with the huge class. Actually, wasn't very polluting because it was just steam. But I don't think too many of those even exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
In America, most of the ones that are left are diesel, and then there's a few corridors that are electric, such as in the Northeast Corridor between D.C. and Boston. I believe that whole corridor is electrified. So it's much cleaner. There's no fumes at all other than from the power plant itself.
And it's also really quiet. When I was in Tokyo, I couldn't believe that there are two things about the, well, there's many things about the Tokyo trains that just I didn't know about that really helped me understand how comfortable the trains were. One had to do with the sound.
Right.
That there wasn't that much sound. There were all these, I would call flats, apartments, very dense, extremely dense, denser than many of the things that we would think about as dense in cities. And those apartments would be right next to the trains. And I even stood next to the trains. I couldn't hear that much of it. Not that I was deaf. I have perfect hearing.
I mean, in France, if they have the very, you know, the same sophisticated trains that Japan has. In fact, a lot of Europe does. Germany, Spain is building them like crazy now, too. They're not completely quiet. I mean, if you stand near the tracks and one of them goes by at 200 miles an hour,
it's just because of the air displacement. That's what you're hearing.
Well, and you're also hearing the rails, the wheels on the rails. It's steel against steel. But, you know, they're nowhere near as noisy as an airplane or as a highway full of trucks and cars.
That was what I was thinking, too, about noise, because let's just talk about noise in general, because as we get more industrialized, noise pollution starts to get a lot more every 10 years.
And right, and probably the most noise, like, if, you know, you think of people moving back to cities and living the city life, probably most of the noise you hear in a city are from the cars and the trucks and the taxis honking their horns all the time. If you go to some cities in Europe, say Amsterdam or Copenhagen or Venice, you're right smack in the middle of a dense city and you hardly hear a peep. I mean, you hear footsteps.
That is what blew my mind, too, in Tokyo. I only heard one honk in Tokyo when I was there for a week. And apparently, there's only two guesses why people don't use the horn.
They're probably more
reason.
Polite there.
Yeah.
Compared to New York. I mean, they're driving with one hand on the horn the whole time, the taxi driver.
I remember in Rome, people would drive with the horn. They use it as an expression, almost like a middle finger or something.
Hit the gas, hit the horn. Hit the gas, hit the horn.
And we would make jokes that the horn was a way to, it's almost like if you didn't press on the gas when the light would turn green,
They
would honk, exactly.
Or they honk at you even 2 seconds before to get ready.
Almost like you would have to be an Olympian to react to that green light.
Right.
And most people don't have that kind of reaction time. I mean, no human, usually you have to be a bionic person to react to that, and usually they use the horn.
Right.
And I couldn't get over how quiet it was in the middle of Tokyo.
That's nice.
And then I realized when I looked at many of the cars in Tokyo, almost all the cars were there for commercial reasons. Whether it was a taxi, it was a delivery. You didn't see just like a whole bunch of cars where people were just going to the museum.
Well, I think in Tokyo, they have a very high train ridership and very low car use.
It's the highest.
Which is great.
Per capita.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe the sound. There was none.
And not only sound, but you have cleaner air, too. If you don't have all those cars spewing out all their exhaust,
I know.
The air is cleaner.
So the sound, and so going back to the sound pollution and the train, not the trains, but I'm talking about the airplane, is that the sound from an airplane, it's wherever their airplane routes are, right?
Well, and it's louder when you're closer to the airport, cause especially for takeoff. That's extremely loud because they're gunning the engines from the ground all the way up until they get up to whatever 10,000 feet or something. So if you happen to be in a city where the planes are taking off right over you, it's noisy all the time. But if you're further, once the planes get up 20, 30,000 feet, you barely hear them. It's just a smaller sound.
Yes, so the comparison of the noise, when you compare a train noise to an airplane noise, what you're saying is that the sound is louder over a greater distance when the plane is taking off and landing.
And the other thing is the difference between trains and planes is that the train station is not a noisy, noxious place like an airport is. So you can have it right smack in the middle of your city. Because that's where the trains are slowing down and creeping in, and then they just stop. And it's so quiet, there's no pollution, nothing, compared to being near an airport is the most noxious part of a flight in a way. So that always has to be way out on the edge of town, and then it adds that much more time to your trip to get way out there to the airport and then to get back from the airport at the other end.
You're also talking about time, a great point. I want to move into time. I couldn't get over how in Tokyo and probably places in Europe, the train is, it's basically to the second.
Right.
On time. And if a train is delayed for 1 hour, it's on the news.
Well, in some countries it's better than others. I think England is probably one of the most punctual train systems on earth. And maybe China and Japan as well. France is pretty darn good too.
So the punctuality.
Italy is probably, you can always add an extra 10 minutes. Things are a little looser there.
I know. And then going on with the the time factor, the way the trains are laid out in Tokyo is apparently different than how they're laid out in Europe. The trains apparently go from like Tokyo to more of the suburbs.
Mm.
So there's actually a lot of people that live in the suburbs that commute to Tokyo.
Right.
And so maybe it's just the way it's organized, like how that whole, the transportation system is organized, that you can still live in a suburb that's kind of compact and then put everybody in the trains to go to the bigger cities.
Well, and also you can have metro systems and regional trains that service lower density suburbs and feed people to the high speed train station, and then that
exactly
takes
and
everybody
exactly.
straight into the
exactly.
center of Tokyo.
So
you can actually shape a whole country around a multi-level train system.
Great. So we'll talk more about train systems. We'll be back. I'm here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org, or that's www.newurbanism.org, and this is Emmy Louie, and we'll be back. We are back. I am Emmy Louie, and we're talking about trains and how they basically can be connected in different forms and fashion that connect suburbs to major cities. We're here with Andy Kunz, and can you explain more about that, Andy?
Well, if you look at a lot of the European countries, they've been doing this for years. Their cities are compact and walkable, and multiple levels of trains, trams and regional trains and high-speed trains, and they all sort of form a web of movement systems locally, regionally, and nationally so that the majority of people can move around that way quickly and easily and not have to have a car. And that's what this country is now starting to struggle with as gas prices go through the roof and we realize that there might even be shortages of oil and gas. So, you know, there's no better model in the world than France and England and Germany in putting the cities and the transport systems together to be a sustainable form of development.
Going back to what I was saying when I was in Tokyo, and you might want to comment on this, is that when I wanted to go from Tokyo to a smaller place, I couldn't go from a smaller place to a smaller place. I would have to go from a small city back to the big city, and then from the big city back to the small city. What would be a good analogy to that?
Well, and that's not always the case, and mm-hmm. Since I haven't been to Tokyo, I don't know a lot about how their cities and trains are laid out.
It probably has to do with their scheduling.
Well, and usually you put the highest speed, most expensive trains on the busiest corridors, city center to city center. You wouldn't run them out to the suburbs because it doesn't make financial sense.
That's correct.
So, but you could have slower regional trains that go suburb to suburb. They don't all have to feed into the center city. I mean, if you look at London, they have British Rail, which is their regional system, and then they have the Tube system, which is their metro, and that goes, many of them feed into the center of the city, but many of them also do loops around the city, so you could go from one suburb to a whole string of other suburbs by the metro or by the British Rail system. So
you're talking about two different routes to get from a small suburb to a small suburb.
Yeah, if you think about a city like, let's say, a donut, you know, and the hole in the donut is the downtown, the very dense part, and then the body of the donut is more of a collection of suburbs sort of all ringed together. Well, the first trains they built are from center city out, like a spur going out. Then the next trains, once those are all in place, and the next trains they build are like a ring road type train that loops around the outside of the downtown, and then they do another one outside of that rings around the body of, say, the donut, if you imagine a donut. So London, I believe, has two or three of those ring trains, whereas D.C. hasn't built any yet. That's supposed to be their next one, is the Purple Line, they call that.
Isn't that similar to in interstates, how people have the beltway?
Exactly. So it's like a beltway train. And then once an area matures and they keep investing, then that's the next thing you build is the beltway train, and then that's the one that goes suburb to suburb to suburb all the way around. And then at any one of those centers of the suburbs, you can switch to a train that goes straight into the city center. And see, D.C. hasn't got there yet. D.C. has, I think, 5 or 6 lines that all radiate out from the center, and then the next one they're talking about is the Purple Line, which is to be like a beltway, looping a big loop around the perimeter. Because it's the same thing here. If you're out in one suburb and you need to get to the next suburb over, you have to go all the way into the center of D.C. and then ride back out on, some of them are on the same line or some are on a different line, out to the suburb in that same sort of diagonal direction.
Yes, so there's the two ways. So it's almost like the radio way of traveling, radio going back to the center or doing a loop around.
Right.
And
they work well together. I mean, that's what you need to really get a lot of people riding. You need
both.
And you need several of the rings. You need an inner ring and an outer ring. And, you know, and that's what America's going to have to really go on a major train building project here to catch up to this, to catch up to even what Europe already has in terms of getting the systems in place so a lot of people can ride that way, because
mm-hmm.
you know, the car systems are rapidly failing before our eyes, and people are switching to trains, and there's not enough trains. There's not many cities don't even have any, and the cities that do have them, they're totally overloaded,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have any money to expand them, and mm-hmm. sometimes they don't even have tracks, you know, in place to expand them. And so it's like, you know, we're going to be up against a wall here real quick.
Mhm. Well,
I was just seeing
the
news.
Individually go on a diet as Americans. Now we got to go on a diet of oil.
Whether we want to or not, it's gonna happen. I mean, because it's getting extremely. I think today I just saw oil. The price of a barrel of oil is up like $6.60 an hour ago. I looked at it. Just today, and yesterday it was up $5, so that's almost $12 in 2 days. That's phenomenal.
I can't even imagine what people would be ending up doing besides sharing their homes and not going on vacations.
Well, the vacations have already stopped. I mean, you could hear it recently, people, they're all piling on to any trains that exist and switching and doing everything they can, and you know, the problem is we've got so many homes in America that are just built standalone in the suburbs, 50 miles from anything, and there's no trains that even exist in many of these places. So these people are all stuck. That, you know, even if they want to cut back, all, you know, what if you have to get to work every day, how do you cut back unless you, like, carpool, you know, with 10 of your neighbors, but usually they're all going in 10 different directions. So, I mean, it's a real crisis that's unfolding right as we speak. I mean, I really didn't expect it to happen this quick, but it's happening right now. So it's going to put a lot of pressure on the politicians and, you know, local, state, and federal level to get off their rears and do something to solve this once and for all. Instead of calling in the oil company executives and drilling them on the price, that isn't going to solve it. They're going to have to build train systems and a lot more walkable communities where we cannot continue to depend on cars and oil. It's just not possible.
I want to talk about the subsidies or how these train systems get subsidized or paid for, because I always go back to my Tokyo experience, and I didn't realize when I went, I realized when I went to Tokyo that there are a number of different lines, and a number of them were privately owned. Some of them were subsidized by the government. Some were regionally subsidized, and some were public-private partnerships. Every single kind of combination you would have, you basically would find. And the only reason why I even knew that it was a different train line is because I couldn't buy one ticket, like one pass
right.
for all of the trains. I actually had to buy different tickets for different lines, and then when I got on the line, for one line, the voice would be a certain voice. It says, like, you know, get off here or something. And then when I go on a different line, it was a different voice. And that's when I knew that it was a different train.
Well, you know, a lot of the early trains in London, and in fact, a lot of them were separate companies, and they owned their own hotel, which was usually right above the train station. And they were competing companies, and many of them were built to make land valuable. Like, you know, a developer would own a piece of land out in the suburbs, and he would either build the train himself or cooperate with a train company to bring a train line out to his property, which would give his property instant value because now you've got a connection into the city. And so you look at London, a lot of those train lines, there's several of them that were train stations right near each other, that they were competing companies. So many of them were started that way, and then it sort of, you know, there was disinvestment over the years and a lot more focus on roads and airports, and so the train system sort of went down, and some of them were nationalized. But, I mean, in France right now, and in fact, much of the EU, I think it's in 2 years, they're opening up all the train systems to competition. The government is going to own all the tracks, separate companies for each country, and then the train operators it's going to be open to competition from private operators. So they're expecting airlines are going to jump in and get into the train business and compete with, say, the Eurostar and some of the others. So, and that might be a good thing. I mean, France, they already run really well now, even though a lot of it, they are separate companies, but most of them are government-sponsored or government partnerships. Like, each region is a different company, but many of them are partnerships with the government or even, like, wholly owned by the government. But, you know, in France, they work really well as it is, so I don't know if opening up the competition is better or worse, but that's what they're doing. They've made a new EU rule that all the train systems are going to be open to competition. So, and that, what the good thing about that is that then people can, private investors can jump in, big insurance companies can jump in and invest and really make it a great system, because it really is the future. In Italy, it's a private consortium of companies that are building the new high-speed lines. I think it's from, like, Rome to Milan, and some of them are car companies, like Fiat, and I think Ferrari is in there. So that's kind of visionary and unusual. But I think we're going to need to see that in this country. We're going to need to see, you know, all new tracks built like they did in France, and they're doing now in Spain and China and a whole bunch of other countries, and then open it up to private companies. So, say, General Motors could even jump into the train business, or United Airlines, or even Exxon, you know, an oil company could get in the train business.
Welcome back. I'm Emmy Louie, and here we are with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org, www.newurbanism.org, and we're talking about trains. Andy's a favorite topic, and Andy, you were saying about, what were you saying in the last few minutes?
Well, that how you were saying that, you know, in Japan there's different private investors involved, and some are government partnerships, and I was saying the same thing in Europe and in France, and that they're actually in the EU, they're opening up all the train systems to more competition, to allow more private operators to come in, and the government will operate the tracks, and then each train system or network or region could be operated by private companies. And I was saying that, you know, we need to do the same thing here in America, that we need to get the government to build a bunch of new tracks, and then all these different companies could jump in. I mean, there's no reason why United Airlines couldn't start operating a train, or even Exxon, you know, is what I was saying, or General Motors. I mean, I don't see why, if it is a profitable business, if they run it with new trains and nice tracks and everything.
And transportation is extremely lucrative.
It's huge. I mean, it's like 30% of our budgets or something like that. I mean, it's huge. You think about all the people transport, goods and food, and I mean, it's a huge industry, multiple billions of dollars of industry. So, You know, and the problem is now all our transport systems are failing because they're all old infrastructure and they're all dependent on oil. So we really need to get into gear and build tomorrow's transportation system, which is basically trains, and they can all be powered by renewable energy, and we could have a great future and still move around the country. Whereas now it's like people are canceling vacations and cutting back on trips to the movies and all these things, which is just really screwed up.
Well, when you talk about these trains, I know last time we talked about the freight system and that the freight trains are actually in good shape in the United States. There's actually a large percentage of usage on freight trains. Would these rider transit trains for people movers, would this be next to freight trains? How would that work?
Probably ideally not. Probably since we have to build new track anyway, if you really want to have a nice system like France or Japan, we just need to locate new strips of land. It could be near highways or even down the middle of a highway or even in the lanes of a highway. But it needs to go to the cities, city centers, you know, and then, the problem with the freight is that you can't try to run passenger and freight trains together. It just will never work, and the passenger trains will always take a back seat. And the freight business, they're not compatible, and they don't operate well together because the freight is very slow and very heavy, and, you know, they don't need perfectly smooth tracks to go fast. They don't even go fast. So in France, they just built all separate tracks. Sometimes they were near the other train. Sometimes they just went right out across the countryside with it by itself.
Very good.
And you know, they work great. I mean, I just was there and rode from south of France all the way to London by high-speed train, and it was seamless. I had to change trains one time in Paris, and, I mean, it was a pleasure the whole way. So simple, no delays. It was smooth. It was fast. It was efficient. We're way behind in this country. And the problem is it's really hurting us economically. I mean, because right now people are canceling trips and everything because of the price of gas to drive or the price of flying, and that flying is such a hassle that it's like no one even wants to go through it unless you just have to. So it's just making people not go anywhere. So it's hurting our travel industry. It's hurting numerous other industries, and it's just going to, you know, wipe out our country.
What about weather, too? Because I know in the winter there's always delays on planes. What about trains? It's not the same, right?
No, they can travel almost any
time,
whereas planes are constantly having problems with heavy rains and heavy snows and fog. And the trains are hardly ever stopped, even snow. I mean, they have trains that'll just one sweep down the track, they clear all the snow off, so then all the rest of the trains run right through it. I mean, look at, they run in Switzerland and places like that, Germany, that has all kinds of snow and mountains. And I was just saw something on the news today about, they're talking about, I think it was in Colorado, of putting in a train so that, because I think it said that the roads were shut down 20 or 30 times last year during ski season because of snows and all that, and so they want to put a train in just so that people can get to where they're going without constant problems.
I have heard that. People who live in Colorado, they have problems getting to work because of getting snowed in.
Right. So,
and if you're in Europe, if you're living in the middle of Switzerland, getting snowed in, I don't know.
Well, you have to still be able to get to the train station, but, you know, they're usually small towns, and you don't have to walk very far, and they probably shovel the sidewalks or whatever. So, I mean, it doesn't seem to be a problem in Europe.
I know.
They have it figured out. They've been doing it for, you know, 100 years or more. So the main message I guess I would give is just that, you know, if we want America to have a future, we really have to build a transportation system that can hold up in the future. because most of the ones we have now really don't have a future because they're all dependent on oil. And it's really hard to just switch out the oil for something else. It's almost every other something else that they've looked at has problems, like biofuels and all these others. So,
are there other, is there a membership? Tell me about some new urbanism groups. Can you tell me about that and how people can get involved?
Well, the main organization that's a membership organization is the Congress for New Urbanism. And their website is www.cnu.org. And they probably have 4,000 members all around the country. It's a national organization. They're in Chicago. And then they have local chapters in many cities. And once a year they have a conference. And those conferences are always great because they bring together all the leaders and all the great thinkers, and they present projects and critique each other. And you know, it's very open to new ideas, and they're not dogmatic and egotistical. I mean, they're very much about finding solutions and trying to get the best things built for people. And they're all about sustainability and saving energy, and it's really quite amazing.
That's great. We're here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. I am Emmy Louie, and we will be back. I am Emmy Louie, and we are back. We're here with Andy Kunz, and we're talking about new urbanism. And new urbanism is about having compact, walkable communities, as well as connecting those communities with the national and regional rail service. And there's many ways that we have actually talked about the subject with uses of examples of just our own personal examples, as well as looking at it from oil, the cost of oil, and then also looking at just current development patterns. There's many different ways that we can talk about this, and I wanted to talk about cul-de-sacs, and that there is two sides of the story as far as cul-de-sacs. What does New Urbanism say about cul-de-sacs, Andy Kunz?
Well, New Urbanism was somewhat of a reaction to suburbia and suburban sprawl, and suburbia is characterized by standalone neighborhoods. They're not even really neighborhoods. They're just housing subdivisions. And the difference is the definition of a neighborhood means you have all the uses there. And in the suburbs, they don't. It's always just homes, and they're usually only in just a certain price range. And the layout of them were usually one big grand entrance with a wall and a gate and fountains and palm, in Florida, the palm trees and all this. And then you would wind way back in there, and then there would be all these little isolated pods of homes, basically all of them with cul-de-sacs. And, if you ask someone who lives in a cul-de-sac, they're going to say, oh, well, it's great because we don't have a lot of traffic and our kids can play in the street and all that. But the downside is, and the problem New Urbanism has with it, is that it's not a connected network, so it forces you to drive all these other miles to get out of your place, to get out of your subdivision, out of your cul-de-sac, onto the arterial road, down to the collector road, and out the main entrance of the subdivision, to get to the nearest store or whatever. So it creates a very disjointed town plan, so to speak, because it's all isolated, dead-end streets. There's not this connected grid like a typical historical city would have, where you have lots of options and lots of ways to move around.
And I'm going to give you my personal example, is that in a cul-de-sac, my child can play in the cul-de-sac without that much traffic. At the same time, I'm separated. My child is separated from another person in that another cul-de-sac because I can't get to the other cul-de-sac without driving my car.
Right. And see, there's a,
and that's the separation. It's not the people in the cul-de-sac separation. It's a separation from one cul-de-sac from another cul-de-sac.
Well, if you look on an aerial photo, you can go on Google and look, click on maps, and then go to any suburb, and then click on aerial photo, and you can see all the cul-de-sacs. There's hundreds and hundreds of them. They call them dead worms, so to speak, because they go every which direction, and hundreds of them all looping all over the place, and no one's connected to anyone. And so the only road that connects them all are the big six-lane arterial roads where you don't want your kid anywhere near it. So, yeah, it's good for your immediate environment, but for the bigger environment, it's terrible. So you have to sort of weigh those two. And, you know, the time your kid can play in that cul-de-sac versus the time you're stuck in traffic trying to take your kid other places, the time you're in traffic because of those non-connected streets is probably far worse than the benefit your kid gets from his use of the cul-de-sac.
Also, another promotion of cul-de-sacs is that it's safer because of traffic, and there was a poll that people said that it was safer from cars, and that's actually a perennial problem, is really how to interface between people on the sidewalk and people in cars.
Well, I'm sure, like you said, if you just look at it in an isolated situation, living on a cul-de-sac is definitely safer for your kids than living in more of a gridded,
mixed-use place. So it depends how you slice it.
But
what you're saying, but if you look at a bigger picture and how many people get into accidents.
Well, yeah,
that's
what I was just going to say. In the amount of time you have, because you live in a cul-de-sac neighborhood, the amount of time you have to spend driving places in traffic, your risk of an accident is way higher than someone who lives in a city who is walking. You know, it's funny because they always say, oh, well, people escape the cities because of the danger of gangs and being shot or being mugged and all that, and then they move to the suburbs. Well, there's been studies that say that the suburbs are far more dangerous because of car accidents, not because you're going to get mugged or shot, but the chance of you getting into a car accident is much higher in the suburbs and actually seriously injured or killed. So, you know, what we thought was safer and greener ends up being more dangerous. It's a different kind of danger, but it's actually more prevalent and more likely that you'll get into a car accident in the suburbs than you'll get mugged in a city.
You also mentioned earlier an interesting point. You said a suburb is not a neighborhood. Is that
right? Even though they call it a neighborhood and they have all these fancy names like Deer Run and, you know, all this kind of stuff. The big joke is that they always name it after what they wiped out to create it. You know, so they wiped out the deer population and their running grounds, and they call the place Deer Run. The deers have no chance of living anymore because of that place being built. But the definition of a neighborhood means a complete place where everything exists. Jobs, shops, apartments, homes, you know, all the ranges of housing options, work options, and shopping options all put together, integrated. That's what a neighborhood is. And so all these suburban cul-de-sac subdivisions are not neighborhoods. None of them are neighborhoods. And even though they all call them neighborhood and they all have their identity and their logo and their fancy wall and their fancy entrance, none of them are real neighborhoods. Housing pods is what they are.
And talking about fancy entrances and gated communities, I've always thought about this, but do people ever think about this and people think that they live in a gated community, that they're safe? And then I'm thinking, well, who actually cleans your house? Who installs all, what about all the technicians that come into the place that...
Well, technically, they probably are safer, but, I think it's a fake fear. What are they really safe from? I mean, are there gangs roaming the suburbs? I mean, the second you pull out of that gate and you get in traffic, all of that safety of your gate is no longer. And now, you know, the risk of you getting injured or killed in a car accident is huge. So, you know, you have to look at one outweighs the other. If you live in a city, you're not exposed to those kinds of traffic accidents and, you know, people doing 50 miles an hour down a collector road. So you don't have a gate either, but it's like an artificial security. I think it's a marketing gimmick more than it really is a security thing. Then the problem is one subdivision is competing against the next, so they say, oh, well, we have a gate. And the other guy goes, well, you know, I want to live in the gate. You know, I have the option of living in this one with the gate or that one without the gate. I want the gate. Even though, you know, what are they really protecting them from? Most of the new urbanist communities, none of them have gates. 90% of them, they don't have gates at all. They're open and connected to surrounding neighborhoods and connected to...
Well, what I'm really surprised about is that some of us actually buy into that.
Well, a lot of people do. I mean, they have for millions of people have because it really is a powerful marketing tool. You know, they say...
This whole sense of security.
These are the amenities of this subdivision. You have a private gate with a security guard. You have a clubhouse with a pool. You know, and that's it. Whereas a town is much better amenities. You have restaurants and shops and, you know, jobs and public transport and all these other things. So when you're, if you don't have any of those to sell as part of your marketing, then you got to hook on to anything you can. Like, oh, we have a golf course and we have a security gate.
Okay.
That's all they got going for
so
them.
So you talked about is the selling aspect of it. That's a really good point. And thank you, Andy Kunz, for being on the show. I really thank you because I'm asking all these questions and you have answered every question that I've asked without me telling you what the question is. So I really appreciate it, and you've been very, very clear about the new urbanism principles. Thank you so much. And anything else you want to say, because we are out of time?
I think we're seeing a huge renaissance in cities, for sure, and it's a great thing because it's not only better quality of life, but it's actually much more sustainable and much less use of energy. And people are happier living in mixed-use places and cities. Now, most people were very isolated in the suburbs, and I think they really felt it. No one understood it right away, but I think they felt isolation, and now I think we're seeing a great resurgence, which is great.
Well, good for you. And do visit the website www.newurbanism.org. I am Emmy Louie. You're listening to The Emmy Louie Show. And thank you, Andy Kunz, for being on our show. And take care.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.